In part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal in Champaign, offering guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes, made of pure wool or silk pile. Since 1992, Eastern Rug Gallery has provided cleaning, repair, and restoration of handmade rugs.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with South Africa's best-known AIDS activist. His name is Zaki Achmat. He's one of the founders of an organization called the Treatment Action Campaign. This was put together back in 1998, and the objective was to put pressure on the government of South Africa to provide medicine, antiretroviral drugs, to everyone in South Africa who needed them, particularly people who could not afford them. It's a campaign that ultimately was successful, although there continue to be criticisms of the government for how well it's doing this. And that is one of the things that we'll talk about on the program this morning. He is here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, Realizing Human Rights, Access to HIV/AIDS-Related Medication, and the Role of Civil Society in South Africa. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. That's on Illinois Street in Urbana. This is, as I say, an event in the MillerCom series, also sponsored by the Center for African Studies. Anyone who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana should feel welcome to stop by. These programs are always free and open to the public. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He grew up in Cape Town during apartheid. Comes from a Muslim family. When he was a teenager, he was involved in student uprisings against apartheid. He was arrested and tried several times. He's also founder of the National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality. And as its director, this was in the early 90s, he worked to ensure protections for gays and lesbians in the new South African Constitution. Also, before starting the Treatment Action Campaign, he was director of the AIDS Law Project based out of the University of Witwatersrand. He was voted in 2004 one of the top 100 great South Africans. He was also, in 2004, nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by an American Quaker humanitarian group, the American Friends Service Committee, and has gotten a lot of recognition both in Africa and around the world for his work. And we're very pleased to have him here on the program. Questions also are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you for being here.
David, it's a pleasure.
I appreciate it.
It really is a pleasure.
Perhaps you'd talk a little bit about the founding of the Treatment Action Campaign. And this was not something that you did by yourself. Obviously, there were a number of people who were involved in this. This was in 1998. What were you at that time hoping to accomplish?
In December 1998, in fact, during that year, a group of us had learnt over the last 2 years then that antiretroviral medicines, especially combination therapy, had become very effective in treating people living with HIV. Three very important things happened. One was that our government refused to allow pilot programs to go ahead to test whether antiretrovirals reduce mother-to-child transmission. Now, we knew that it did, and the government refused to do that. Two very good activists, a woman called Gugu Dlamini, was stoned to death because she declared her HIV status publicly, and someone who I regarded as a leader both in the anti-apartheid movement, in the gay and lesbian movement, and also in the AIDS movement, called Simon Cordy, died of AIDS-related illnesses. And together with that, one of my closest friends and a really great South African, Justice Edwin Cameron, is a judge who lives openly with HIV, started medication. And I personally witnessed how the medication transformed his life. And even as a judge, he could not afford the medication. And there was one year in particular where we had to assist him as friends to donate money, because otherwise he would have had to sell his house. Now, at the beginning of all this, we all assumed, myself, Mark Haywood, Sharoni Kambaram, Mercy Makhalamele, Anne Lebete, all of us assumed that our battle would really have been with the drug companies and not with our own government. Regrettably, the opposite turned out to be the case. Of course, we battled with the drug companies, but the real battle ended up against our own government.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, the campaign that you were involved in, and also in cooperation with a lot of people in South Africa, particularly with trade unions.
Right.
Eventually, this was successful in that finally the government said, yes, we will provide medicine, at least beginning with the people who are the sickest.
Right.
Now, that was a couple of years ago, and right. still to this day, I know you and others have been very critical of the government, saying essentially that the effort has been, it's been too slow, it's not going as well as it should. What can you say about the job that the government has done to date in trying to provide these medicines to people who need them?
Well, at the moment, access to medicines is like winning the lotto in South Africa. You have to be lucky. You have to be lucky to live in an area where access to medicines is where you will have access. To give you an example, I'm going to just go back into what the AIDS epidemic looks like in South Africa at the moment, and so that it gives you some background. South Africa is one of the countries with probably the highest number of people living with HIV. Between 5.5 million and 6.5 million of the people living in South Africa have HIV out of a population of 42 million people. Now, last year alone, we had 500,000 new infections. That is unsustainable. It's unsustainable because it takes away the dignity and the autonomy of individuals when they become infected with a life-threatening condition, even though it's a chronically manageable condition. Because what it means is you become sick. It means that you become a difficult burden on your family, especially in contexts where the state healthcare service is not that good. Very importantly, if you're a breadwinner, your family's income gets reduced. If you're not a breadwinner, you drain economic resources on your family. In addition to that, your community suffers and the country suffers. So every new infection is a very serious problem. So 500,000 new infections last year is what our country faced. In addition to that, we had approximately 300,000 AIDS-related deaths. Our government did a study of 3 million death certificates, which showed that the average age of death among adults had come down from people in their 60s and 70s to people in their 30s. So today, you're most likely to die in South Africa when you're 30. More people in our country die today than ever died under apartheid or colonialism. And that is a tragedy because this government, the current government we have, is probably one of the best governments we've ever had in asserting the dignity, the equality, and the freedom of black people. So it's a really remarkable and a tragedy that these two things have coincided. Now, at the moment, on the government program, you would find that only about 110,000 out of 700,000 people who need medicines have access to medicines. A further 90,000 get access through workplace programs, through NGOs, and of course through private medical insurance. The biggest problem with government rollout at the moment of the antiretroviral therapy is political leadership, and that is the biggest problem.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Zaki Ahmad. He chairs the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa, a group that he helped found back in 1998 to work to put pressure on the government of South Africa to provide medicine, antiretroviral medicines, to people with AIDS or with HIV in South Africa. Something that a campaign that went on for a long time was eventually successful to the point that the government agreed to start doing this. However, as is explained, he and a lot of other people feel that the effort has not been what it should be. There's still a lot of people who need access to medicine that don't have it. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think your campaign has also been instrumental in doing is to bring down the cost of the medicine by putting pressure on the drug companies to get them to allow generic versions of the drugs to be made in South Africa that cost a lot less. And so for a lot of people, even if they had the money to pay for the medicine, we're still talking about a lot of money. And that certainly would put it out of the reach of an awful lot of South Africans. But I mean, having said that, even though the cost of the treatment has come down, we're still talking about a considerable amount of money. I mean, how much money are we talking about?
Well, today the medicines I take cost me about $45 a month. Prior, when we started the treatment action campaign, it cost $450 a month. The state gets it for about $20 now. But in the 2 years preceding that, it was about $1,500 a month, the cost of combination antiretroviral therapy. So the prices have come down significantly. The biggest problem for us in our healthcare service is the fact that in every place where let me give you an example. We work in a place called the Sikki Sikki in the Eastern Cape, which is one of the poorest rural districts in the country. There are 12 clinics. Every clinic is supposed to have 5 trained professional nurses and a doctor for every 3 clinics to share among them. Every clinic there has 2 nursing assistants instead of the complement of 5 trained nurses. And in that context, when I visited that program last year, there were fewer, and none of the nurses had had a proper holiday for more than 2 years. And in the time that I was there, 2 nurses decided they just couldn't carry on any longer. And they had to close down their clinic, which means that people for miles around could not have access to general healthcare services. And these nurses have to deal with everything from breast cancer to child delivery through casualties to TB to HIV and so on. And so you can imagine the impact that HIV has on a rural clinic like that and access that people have. So the big problem that we have, apart from leadership and the lack of leadership exacerbates these problems, the big problem we have is access to human resources, particularly in our rural areas, and the division between public and private medicine. Because private medicine within our country, that's private health insurance and so on, takes a lot more money and covers much fewer people. So the public health sector covers 80% of our population for exactly the same money that the private healthcare sector does with 20% of the population. Now, for all of us, we know that the big problems that lie ahead is still to continue bringing the prices of medicine down, but also to ensure that we have new generations of nurses, of pharmacists, of doctors, and so on, who can assist the government to roll out treatment, but not only treatment for HIV and prevention for HIV, but most importantly, to ensure that everyone has equal access to healthcare services.
There has been a lot of criticism, both in South Africa and really from around the world, of the South African government, particularly of the president, Thabo Mbeki, because of the things that he has said about AIDS, questioning whether there was some link between AIDS and HIV, about whether these drugs were useful, about whether they were potentially toxic. And apparently there was at one time a huge furor in South Africa because Mr. Mbeki said he personally didn't know anybody who had died of AIDS, when clearly that was not true. His own spokesman died of AIDS. And yet here he is saying, well, I don't know anybody who's died of AIDS. One wonders, why do you think, I would guess you have had some opportunity to talk with him about this personally, and if not with him, with the woman who is the Minister of Health for South Africa. Why do you think Mr. Mbeki takes this position, thinks what he does, say the things that he has that seem to go against such solid science about AIDS?
Well, you know, It's a deeply regrettable that science is so misused by politicians across the world. I mean, in your own country, you have a president who doesn't believe in global warming, or he doesn't believe or finds it difficult to allow people access to condoms, or more importantly, now with the human papillomavirus. So it's regrettable that politicians interfere in science, and in our case, it has cost many, many hundreds of thousands of lives. President Mbeki has been responsible directly for the loss of life of thousands of people in South Africa. And I don't say that to be nasty to him as a man or even as a president. It is a fact and is a truth. And if we don't speak the truth about it, it's a huge problem. I think his biggest problem is that he considers he has seen his own project as African renewal, as an African renaissance, for his terms. And for him, the so-called West, and I hate using words like that, but the so-called West sees Africa as a place that is diseased, a place of sexual promiscuity, a place of very deep poverty. And HIV for him triggers all those sentiments or beliefs and so on. And it's a perception that he has internalized and one that he is trying to escape. And regrettably, the perception he has of Africa and South Africa and the perception that the West has, if it's true, so what? If it's not true, it doesn't run counter to the fact that, yes, in fact, despite the fact that Brazil has a lot of sex, the Brazilians aren't scared of saying we have a lot of sex. They're a deeply Catholic country, but they're not afraid of distributing condoms and talking about them and saying use them. And therefore, their program has been fairly successful. If the Brazilian president, the former president, whose name escapes me now, and the current president, Lula, had said, well, we don't want the world to believe that Brazilians are promiscuous and allowed their people to die, they would have been very foolish indeed. In fact, they did their people and the world a service by proving that prevention and treatment can succeed. And the regrettable thing in South Africa is our president has undermined scientific institutions in our country. The Medical Research Council has had to try and... there was a study that they did showing the amount of deaths related to AIDS, the demographic, the impact on death of AIDS. And they were forced to not release the study for longer than a year because the president wouldn't believe it. The Medicines Control Council has had to constantly not register antiretrovirals or feel pressure about the registration of antiretrovirals. The South African Human Rights Commission wanted to support the treatment action campaign in our application to force the government to ensure that women had access to antiretrovirals to reduce mother-to-child transmission of HIV. The president stopped the Human Rights Commission from intervening on our side. The list is endless. You can go on and on and on. Currently, there's a vitamin salesman who apparently advertised again this weekend in the New York Times that he can cure bird flu with his vitamins, a chap called Matthias Rath. And this gentleman goes around our country with the president and the Minister of Health's blessing, telling people that they should take his vitamins instead of antiretroviral medicines. This is a man who'd been banned from distributing his medicines in Germany, in England, in the United States. There's a warning from the FDA against him. It's a man who in Germany took a young child away from his parent with his parents to a clinic in Mexico, took him off his conventional cancer therapy, gave him vitamins, and the child died. So in our own country, at least 8 to 11 people have died because they've taken this man's concoctions. So, I mean, the difficulty that we have is that the deep denial is both personal, psychological, scientific, but I believe is based on a perception that this can't be happening to Africa. And it's a deep tragedy because our president, in many other ways, is doing a lot to try and change the continent.
I believe this was last January, Nelson Mandela announced that one of his sons had died of AIDS-related illness, and came out and spoke about this publicly, talked about just what a serious issue this was for the country. And I think a lot of people, you know, were praised Mr. Mandela for having done it. At the same time, and I'm sure within South Africa, criticizing Nelson Mandela is something you do at your peril. I think also there were some people who said, well, that was good that the that Mr. Mandela had done that at that point. And however, they also said that he could have done more, that maybe he was coming to the fight a little late. Do you think that that is true?
Well, I'm a Mandela apologist, so let me try and put it in context. It is true that President Mandela, and he would be the first to admit it, says that he could have done more when he was president. Mm-hmm. But one has to understand the context. He came to power after 27 years in prison. He's a fairly old gentleman, fairly conservative in his outlook. And he said that when he went to a village one day, he spoke to young people and said to them, you have to use condoms. And the chiefs in the village said to him, don't do that. And then he went to a white high school in a free state, now formerly white high school. And the principal said to him, if you want to win the next election, stop. You should not talk to children about condoms. And he said, I stopped speaking about condoms and look at the impact that that has had. And so, I mean, he admitted that degree. But on the other hand, our current president is a centralizer. He centralizes all power in his hands. Whereas President Mandela left his ministers to get on with their job. So he didn't try to be the Minister of Health and the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister of Finance all in one. He let these ministers get on with their job. Regrettably, our current president has the opposite tendency, and he tries to play all the positions on the field simultaneously. And therefore, our current health minister has no independent opinion, no scientific opinion, certainly, independent of that of the president. And the president's opinions are all based on pseudoscience, so it makes life a lot more difficult. President Mandela, to come back to your question, since he left office, has done an enormous amount, not simply raising the profile of AIDS prevention, the care of orphans and so on, but he has given his voice and support not only to the Treatment Action Campaign, but to the broader struggle for access to medicines and globally to trying to ensure that the wealthy countries respond to the needs of the poorer countries. Particularly, I mean, South Africa may not need as much money as, say, Zambia or Malawi or Ecuador or Nicaragua or so on. And President Mandela's lent his authority and his voice to those struggles.
We are at our midpoint just about in this part of Focus, and I think I should introduce again the guest for this hour, Zaki Achmat. He is South Africa's best-known AIDS activist and certainly is well-known around Africa and around the world for his work in this area. One of the founders of the Treatment Action Campaign, that was 1998, founded to put pressure on the government to provide AIDS drugs to people who needed them, particularly people who were too poor to afford them. He has been an active member of the African National Congress when he was younger, was involved in student uprisings against apartheid. He continues to hold membership despite his concerns about the party and how it has responded to the challenge of HIV in the country. He was founder of the National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality. And before starting the Treatment Action Campaign, was director of the AIDS Law Project, based at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. He's here visiting the campus, going to give a talk. This is in the Millercom series, talking about access to HIV and AIDS-related medication and the role of civil society in South Africa. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus. That's on West Illinois and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. Also here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to have you talk a little bit about yourself, particularly your decision now, going back a few years, and this went on for a period of 4 years, where you decided as a matter of conscience, and you yourself are HIV positive, you decided as a matter of conscience that if everyone couldn't have these drugs, you weren't going to take them. And this went on for a period of years. You put your own health at risk. And I think at various points, people asked you not to do this, people who were concerned about you. Even Mr. Mandela apparently stopped by one day and said, Zaki, look, don't do this. And finally, I believe in 2003, you decided, yes, you would take the medication. And I think that was shortly then thereafter, it was when the government finally said, all right, we'll develop a program so that sometime in the future we'll start to provide these medicines. First, maybe you could talk a little bit about why it is that you decided for yourself, even though you could have had the medicine, that if everybody couldn't have it, you weren't going to have it.
Yeah. I think you used the right word, which is a matter of conscience. And I think the conscience part of it really comes from my mum, my late mum. I have five siblings, and it's no question to me that if one of my siblings had HIV, they wouldn't have been able to afford the medicines. The only reason I would have been able to afford it would have been because my friends would have collected money to make sure that I get access. And so for me, it was really a question of, do I want this for myself when my own brothers and sisters would be in a position where they would die because they don't have access? So for me, that was the critical question. I never actually intended it to be a battle with the government. It was intended to, for me, it was an issue of conscience and to draw attention to the inequity between rich countries and poor countries with the profiteering from medicines, not only in South Africa, but globally. There's serious profiteering with medicines, and governments don't do enough to ensure that the pharmaceutical industry is appropriately regulated. I'm not against the pharmaceutical industry making profit, but to ensure appropriate regulation of the pharmaceutical industry so that people have access to medicines. And so for me, that was the basis of the decision. And then, of course, my own stubbornness and stupidity entered into the equation, and that just made it all more difficult. But at the same time, it was, I'm glad it's over.
Oh, I'm sure of that. That you went through difficult times, and did not feel well, and were dealing with a lot of stuff. And I'm sure you said to yourself, you know,
I can tell you. Prior to taking my medicine, I think even here in the United States, it's very, very important that people who know people and people who have HIV themselves and people who think they may be at risk of HIV, and everyone could be at risk if you've had unprotected sex, if you've used drugs, recreational drugs, that is, you could be at risk for HIV. So it's very, very important to go get tested. I can tell you in the year before I went on to my medication, I'm someone who reads about 100, 200 pages a day. Trying to read one page a day would have been very hard work for me. It would have been almost impossible. My concentration went. I had fever. I had migraine-type headaches every day. Mm. I had a viral, a bacterial, or a fungal infection every week. And so it was virtually impossible for me to function as a human being. I functioned at about 20% capacity. And going on my medicines within a week, I'd read a book, 800 pages long, a book on the Spanish Civil War. Within a week, I could scrub my floors, which I hadn't done at home for about 4 years. My housemate invited everyone around to come and look at the spectacle. so it's access to the medication. And yes, I did have side effects. And later, especially from one drug, stavudine, D40, Zeret, I don't know what the other names that you might use here, peripheral neuropathy from it. And I was very stupid. I thought, I'm not going to, because of the dramatic change that the medicines made to my life, the fact that it gave me back energy, took away illness, gave me a new lease on life. I didn't want to admit to myself that these medicines could now be causing a side effect. So that was the one thing. And the second thing was I did a very dumb thing. I thought the Minister of Health and the President are going to misuse the fact that I had a side effect. And one should never, never let anything get in the way of science and decent clinical medicine. And but simple change of regimen helped me in that regard.
Well, so you went for a period of time not feeling well, feeling at a reduced percentage of your productivity. So you couldn't work, you weren't accomplishing stuff, you didn't feel well. A lot of people who were really concerned about you said, look, this doesn't make any sense. Would you please change your mind? What was it that finally got you to the point where you thought maybe started weighing all of that and the your personal cost to your health, the fact that maybe you could honestly say to yourself, if I was healthier, I could accomplish more than what I'm doing now. I mean, what was it that finally got you to the point to realize that maybe it didn't make any sense to keep going like that?
Right. I think critically, most of the objectives that we needed to had been achieved. There was just complete awareness that it was only government stubbornness that was preventing people from accessing medication. And so for me to then kill myself because of government stubbornness would have been very foolish. And so what really convinced me was the fact that it became inevitable that government would have to create a program. And it was just a matter of time. And literally I took my decision at our National Congress, where I was instructed by our National Congress, you have to take your medicines. I took my decision on the 3rd of October, I started my medicines the 5th of September. 3rd of October, I took the decision. And on the 8th of August, 3rd of August, and on the 8th of August, the government announced that it would ask the Minister of Health to develop a program. So literally within days, the government changed its position. And they didn't change it because I'd made my announcement. They changed their position because there was such a huge outcry within South Africa and outside of it. And perhaps this is an area that I'd really like to say thank you and also to address the question of global solidarity and international solidarity. None of what we did would have been possible without assistance from ordinary people in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Zimbabwe, in Namibia, in Thailand. And so it is the assistance of ordinary people, together with their lawmakers and other representatives, NGOs and so on. In the United States, for instance, the NGOs like Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontières, Consumer Project on Technology, ACT UP, Gay Men's Health Crisis, they were all phenomenal in supporting us. And not only us, but many, many, many other people in the developing world in getting access to medicine. So I just want to say thank you.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone in Champaign, line number one.
Yes,
hello.
This is a very fascinating conversation. And ironically, I just read a column in today's New York Times. I'm not sure if either one of you have read it. The column is titled Free Trade and AIDS Drugs. And if you will bear with me, I'll read the pertinent parts. The countries of Southern Africa have the world's highest rates of AIDS infection. These governments have a special need to make or buy low-cost generic drugs to save their citizens. World trade rules are amenable, containing safeguards that allow countries to use generics to preserve public health. But the Bush administration is now negotiating a free trade agreement with the Southern African Customs Union. It is important that the United States does not, in the process, restrict the ability of poor people to get generic drugs in these countries. And my question to you is there any possibility that this could be a situation where all of a sudden generic drugs are no longer available to people in sub-Saharan Africa?
Thanks very much for the question. I think it is a possibility, a remote possibility, that could happen. But the pressure is not on the drugs that are available. The pressure would be on new drugs. If you take, for instance, because at the moment it would be too much of a scandal and an impossibility for governments, because there would be literally riots if people were taken off their medicines because the medicines weren't available. So I don't think the drug companies, and I certainly don't think the Bush administration at this stage, would think about taking people off their current medicines or forcing people on current medicines to not use generics. But there are second-line medicines and there are third-line medicines. There are newer drugs such as tenofovir, such as lopinavir, ritonavir, made by Abbott and Merck and so on. And the question here is whether these drugs would be available. But the other question we have to ask is, it's not simply medicines for HIV. What about medicines for heart disease? What about medicines for arthritis, or medicines for cancer, or a range of medicines, not only in poor countries, but here as well? We're not saying that drug companies should not be able to make profit. What we are saying is that the people who invent the drugs need to be rewarded, and the people who develop them should be able to make some degree of profit. But making excessive profits at the expense of health is not on. And unfortunately, not only in South Africa, but in Thailand, in Morocco, in parts of Central America and so on, the Bush administration has done bilateral deals. And I hope that in Southern Africa, we're going to resist it. But the Bush administration has succeeded partially in Thailand and also in Morocco and other places with doing bilaterals that make the rules more stringent than what the World Trade Organization allows. So it really undermines multilateral institutions.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And again, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. How important is it for a country like South Africa to get international assistance, money, essentially, what we're talking about, to try to help pay the bill?
A a country like South Africa, South Africa is a fairly, except for civil society organizations, our government has enough money. And it's made the money available. It's not money that's the problem in South Africa. It's political will and it's human resources. The problem is in our region, Malawi, Lesotho, Swaziland. Here are countries with absolutely no independent economic base. And it is really critical that the global community, and that's why things like the Global Fund on AIDS, TB and malaria are so important. Your own presidential emergency relief program for AIDS, presidential emergency program for AIDS relief, PEPFAR, as it's commonly known, is one of the biggest programs in terms of money that's been made available to poorer countries. Regrettably, there's some restrictions on using generic medications in certain cases, on people advocating or supporting right to family planning, contraception and termination of pregnancy, sexual and reproductive health. There's also a huge problem in relation to abstinence-only programs. And from our point of view, these are all things that we wish the Bush administration would not place as conditions on the funding of those programs. So in South Africa, the Bush administration is funding some programs. The Global Fund is funding a significant program. The whole of the Western Cape, which is where I'm from, the government program in that area is significantly funded by the Global Fund. So it's very, very important. But if you look at the percentage of money needed to deal, or the percentage of money allocated by the G8 and all our countries, even middle-income countries, towards AIDS and the amount needed, there's a shortfall of about $8 billion a year for prevention and treatment.
Let's talk with someone else. This is also a Champagne caller. Line one. Hello.
Oh, me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. I just had a question. My wife used to work in the pharmaceutical industry in research, and that's when I first became aware of this whole situation. And I was just curious as like in the pharmaceutical industry, it seems like there's the two main branches that take you know all the focus and all the money, and that's research and then marketing and sales, and they put a large percentage of their resources toward research. Well, that because that's how they survive, obviously. And I was just wondering, how do you balance the free market considerations, you know, and the financial incentive against social responsibility and so on? I mean, like, how do you sell these ideas to, you know, free market capitalist companies?
Right. There are a range of responses there. You're right, absolutely right, that many drug companies, and particularly the very big ones like perhaps Pfizer, Merck, and to some degree GlaxoSmithKline, that they do invest a lot in research.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. A much larger amount of money, except perhaps for Pfizer, is spent on marketing. So those adverts, which I get completely shocked at when I come to the United States, of how you need to ask your doctor for this medicine and that medicine and the next medicine, they spend more money on that than they actually spend on research. So that's, mm-hmm. But that's a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
What is much more of concern is that the basic research, a lot of the basic research, and we're talking about basic science research, for many medicines, whether cancer, heart disease, and so on, is conducted within the state sector. So the governments, the NIH in your case, the Centers for Disease Control, in the UK, the Medical Research Council, the Human Genome Project, and all those institutions, they spend huge amounts of public money, taxpayers' money, on research.
And around here, it'd be in the universities, which
exactly.
is what she's doing now.
Exactly. And then what happens is those institutions work with drug companies to further develop it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is at that point that drug companies start taking an interest and developing particular drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our argument would be very clearly that irrespective of the source, public or private, innovation must be rewarded. And the reason we have protection of intellectual property is because it's to allow the public access to new inventions on the one hand and to reward innovators.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that a patent, or as you say, a patent here in the United States, a patent gives a company exclusive monopoly for 20 years, which allows them to charge any price they want, which has nothing to do with the free market if you have a monopoly.
Sure.
And so there's a range of things, and what we would like to see is a model developed where public-private partnerships give money back to the originator as an immediate investment reward, and then take on another 10, 20, 50, whatever years you decide, or a country decides, or all of us decide, in allowing any company to make the medicine at whatever price they charge, and then to get a royalty, a small percent back, as profit over the period of 20 or 50 years. It doesn't matter what the time is, so that companies can get reward. But the model we have at the moment is unworkable, because you have pensioners who have to cross the border into Canada to get access to medicines here, and that's unconscionable.
Well, sure, and obviously if they're spending, you know, $40 billion a year on marketing, they're obviously not hurting too badly on their on their returns.
Yeah. No, I mean, the question is, you're absolutely right. The pharmaceutical industry, regrettably, is not sufficiently regulated like the defense industry.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Questions are welcome. We'd certainly take one or two, perhaps, in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, by the way, in this hour is Zaki Ahmad. He is an AIDS activist from South Africa, continues to be involved with the Treatment Action Campaign that he helped found in 1998. Helped find that to put pressure on the government to provide AIDS medication to people who needed it, particularly people who would be too poor to afford it. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked about the criticisms that have been leveled against the government, the South African government, about, particularly for raising questions about did HIV cause AIDS? Were the medicines toxic? Could you get a better effect by going through nutrition and vitamins? Apparently, the Minister of Health has really been
selling that idea. Garlic, beetroot, and
ginger. And apparently there are, I guess, some people, some South Africans, who have been hesitant to take the medications even if they're available.
Yeah.
They have got this idea that maybe there might be something wrong with them. There might be bad side effects. Maybe traditional sort of approaches would work. I mean, is it difficult even to persuade people to take the medicine even if you hand it to them and say, here it is, and still people to say, no, I'm not sure I want to do that?
What you raise are three questions in that. The one is the stigma associated with HIV. And many, many, many people fear going to get tested because of discrimination, but particularly women, because of domestic violence, because of general violence against women. Our deputy president is up for a charge of rape against someone who he knew was HIV positive. So even if the sex was consensual, to have had sex with someone without a condom who is HIV positive, by someone who is the deputy president and officially in charge of the government's AIDS programs, is an absolute scandal. So the stigma associated with HIV stops many, many, many people from coming forward. So that's a huge battle. Then on top of that, you have the fear that people have of all medicine. And, I mean, that's true here in the United States as it is anywhere in the world, that people fear scientists, whether it's Tuskegee or whether it's what the Nazis did, whether it's what the Soviets did with Lysenko and so on. People fear science, and they fear being experimented on. And so to raise those questions, when your president raises those questions, if you're an ordinary citizen, you're going to think twice before taking those medicines. So there are legitimate fears that you have, the stigma and so on, that would come with anyone. And then on top of that, the denial of the president and the deliberate obfuscation and misleading of people through saying these medicines are far more toxic. So it's a huge question. I would like to say a few words about TAC, if I may, David.
No, yes, please.
You know, it's probably for me the most remarkable thing about post-apartheid South Africa, and I don't say it because I'm in it and so on. It's probably one of the only organizations of civil society which don't have old recycled leadership like me. So I can be pushed off and to go to the United States to go do talks, because we've got a remarkable set of leaders. We have about 16,000 members, which is not that much, but it's in South Africa, it's quite a bit. 80% unemployed, 70% women. Many, many people have not even had a basic education. But what people go through in learning in the Treatment Action Campaign, learning the science of HIV, learning the clinical presentations of the disease and so on, it makes people citizens, and it allows people the right to go and claim, or gives people the confidence to go and claim their rights and so on. So it's been a really remarkable experience for me, but I wish you could see it.
And I think, too, what I'm read is that you also have been interested in expanding the agenda of the campaign beyond the issue of AIDS and treatment for people who have HIV, but to raise more broadly the issue of access to health care.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question that in our country, as well as other countries, there's a very deep division. That people don't have access to basic healthcare services. You know, in our country, the thing that kills most people with HIV is tuberculosis. There hasn't been a new TB drug in 40 years. There hasn't been a TB vaccine since before airplanes started flying. There hasn't been a new TB test for the same time. And so the TB tests we use in Africa, in Asia, and in Latin America today are still the old tuberculosis tests from 50, 60 years ago. They cannot detect TB in people with HIV. Most people with HIV, their TB goes undetected and they die from it because the TB tests are so ineffective. So it's critical that we expand our understanding and not simply be what our government disparagingly calls single issue, although we've never been single issue in that sense, because everyone has a right to decent health care.
We'll see if we can get one more caller in here, at least in the time we have left, over in Terre Haute, Indiana, next door, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I congratulate your speaker. I think most of the problem we have in developing countries are created by developed countries like ours. For example, a medication, I'm a physician, by the way, a medication called Xanax has got 500,000% profit margin. And there was a company in India which produced cheap anti-AIDS medication, which I'm sure your speaker is aware of. And one of our pharmaceutical companies took over that company so that they would not export any cheaper medication to South Africa. So I think the change has to come from rich countries, rather than attaching business ties to any aids which we give. If we didn't were to do that and cut down the pharmaceutical company's profit, the third world countries will be better off.
Just on your comment, I think what the real question you raised there is not so much even the countries, because the difficulty we all have is that across a range of industry, whether it's defense, oil, pharmaceuticals, cars, and so on. Multinational companies have huge turnovers, they have huge expenses, they have a range of things, and they have enormous, enormous power. Very often, they have more power and more money than many poor countries. So their economic power is very strong. You and I, if we commit a crime anywhere or if we fall foul of regulation, we are responsible, and the governments can hold us accountable. International instruments can hold people accountable, whether it's Milosevic or Charles Taylor. But companies are not accountable. They move fast across borders and so on. And the World Trade Organization assists them in regulating and opening up markets for them. But there is no body that holds companies, particularly those who do their business across many different countries. There's no body that holds companies accountable for industrial accidents like the one in Bhopal or for instance, the asbestos-related illnesses in South Africa, or, for instance, medication. So it's very important that citizens like ourselves in Europe, in North America, in Africa, in Asia and Latin America, that we band together and make sure that our governments have the power not to stop business, but but to ensure that business takes place in a rule-bound environment that doesn't destroy people's access to medicines or basic goods and services, and most importantly, obeys international trade rules.
We are going to have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the time. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, however, around the campus, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Zaki Akhmat, he'll be speaking on this very subject, Realizing Human Rights, Access to HIV-AIDS-Related Medication, and the Role of Civil Society in South Africa. This afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. It's an event in the MillerCom series. Also get some sponsorship from the folks at the Center for African Studies. These programs are always free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested in attending can stop by. Our guest, Zaki Akhmat, one of the founders of the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa, organized to, among other things, to put pressure on the government to provide AIDS drugs to anyone in the country who would need them. Thank you very much.
David, thank you very much. Thanks very, very much.
Programming here on our station is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Also, funds for the broadcast today come from a grant from Horeen's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horeen's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Just before we go, a mention of tomorrow morning on the show. In the first hour of the program, we'll talk with Kathleen Cleaver. She is a senior lecturer in law at Emory Law School, visiting professor in law at Yale, and well-known as a human rights activist. We will be talking with her about the Black Power movement, something that she will be here on the campus to discuss a little bit later in the week. She'll be talking with us tomorrow morning by telephone. And then we'll talk with Daniel Pink about his book, A Whole New Mind, Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future. That'll be tomorrow morning in the second hour of the show. We're here weekday mornings, 10 noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. And right now, we hope you will stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will talk with award-winning photographer David Plowden. He's been recording the American landscape for